Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Soleri Report. This evening is Thursday, January 22nd, 2010. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join us this evening. Tonight, Who's Your Sheriff? In an interview with Sheriff Richard Mack, the Arizona sheriff who took the U.S. government to the Supreme Court and won, affirming very important constitutional limits on federal power. But first, I'm going to review the top stories in money and markets, and then some questions and ask Catherine. So, my theme for this week is, what's Plan B? During the year-end wrap-up, I talked a lot about sort of the outlook for the year and what I called the grinding of the gears, which is what happens when everybody has expectations of what they're going to be doing or how things are going to be going, and suddenly they discover that Plan A is not going to work. And part of success is figuring out how to face the fact that your expectations didn't meet how things turned out, and how fast can you invent an effective Plan B. But as you can see from the news this week, there's a lot of people, particularly on Wall Street and Washington, suddenly faced with the challenge of coming up with a Plan B. Now, so let's start with money and markets. I just got back from Vancouver. I was up there for 3 days for the big natural resource conference. Canada is rich in natural resources, and whether it's forestry or mining, gas and oil, it's a place where those industries meet and greet. Vancouver is getting ready for the Winter Olympics, so things were just absolutely booming. There was not one sign of anything other than economic well-being. Occasional homeless people on the street, but the stores were packed, the place was packed. I was there also for the board meeting of the Gold Antitrust Action Committee that I'm on the board of. We have our annual meeting once a year, co-located with a conference, and we focused this year on our lawsuits. We filed at the very end of December a lawsuit against the Federal Reserve as a result of their refusal to comply with our Freedom of Information requests. We had requested detailed information about the gold swaps they're entering into with banks. In one sense, it's a very arcane topic. On the other hand, it's at the very heart of the Federal Reserve's ability to manipulate the precious metals market, which is at the very heart of their ability to manipulate economies and create this two-tiered economy, you know, most of us paying a very high cost of capital and other players paying basically an inside cost of capital. So I'm not going to talk a lot about that tonight, but I want to keep bringing that to your attention because I'm going to talk about a lot of this year. It's very important. They're along with sort of the efforts to bring disclosure to the Federal Reserve, whether it's Ron Paul's efforts to require an audit or Bloomberg's wonderful lawsuit on, again, Freedom of Information Act issues, which prove they won in district court, and now it's moving to appeal. The top story this week is, in fact, the Supreme Court, and we're going to be talking with Richard Mack more about his Supreme Court case, but, in fact, out today, a 5-4 decision that strikes down a 1907 law, the net result of it basically says is that corporations can finance political ads. And this has really profound impacts about the balance of power between creditors and citizens, because now what we're saying is corporations globally can spend significant amounts of money to sway elections. One of the provisions insists that there needs to be disclosure about who's paying. Maybe that will be helpful. We had one amazing member of our network today on the on our prayer call. We do a public prayer call once a week. Said, you know, now Congress, people in Congress should be required to wear corporate patches just like NASCAR races. And you almost wonder if it hasn't gotten so bad that it's really going to tank the system, but it's pretty amazing. Next week I'm going to be talking, not next week, but in February 4th, in the next Soleri report next month, I'm going to be talking about sort of the techniques that can be used to manipulate people like Supreme Court justices to come out with a case which is so frightening in its impact. And I think it's important to understand those issues to help you understand things like how a Supreme Court literally could be coerced to come up with something that's ridiculous. It does underscore, again, the importance of using our individual decisions as to where we put our time and attention and our money as our real power, because increasingly, whether it's control of the voting systems or the Supreme Court decisions, corporations are rising ever more in power within the machinery, and that brings it back to our ability to affect brand or purchase flows and investment flows privately. So it underscores, again, the importance of our intimate choices with money, because more and more that's where our influence is going to be. Now, we had, in addition to the Supreme Court decision, talk about coming up with a plan B in the wake of the extraordinary victory of a Republican come-from-behind candidate in Massachusetts. We now see the Democrats losing their 60-senator majority in the Senate, and a real signal that the Republican Party is in a much stronger position in the coming elections. In one sense, the Massachusetts senatorial race is deemed to be a referendum on health care, and we see the president quickly backing away from the current health care legislation in Congress, really, and the Democratic leadership really in a quandary about what to do. At the same time, we see the president announcing today a series of more draconian financial reforms. Interestingly enough, if you look at the picture, Volcker is now standing next to him and Timmy Geithner several people away. The stock prices of the big financials were down, so Goldman Sachs was down $6, closing at about $140. Citibank down 19 cents, closing at $3.27. J.P. Morgan down $2.86, closing at $40. Bank of America down $1, closing at $15. All things considered, it's not down very much. Obama is in an absolutely dreadful political position. Essentially, what happened was he used the incredible wave of popularity and support that came with his election to engineer $12 trillion of bailout money into the financial systems, effectively refinancing out the fraudulent paper that had been floated to engineer what I've described many times as the coup d'etat. If you want to hear more on that whole subject, I would read or listen to the year-end wrap-up. The blog post is called The Year, 2009, The Year of the Giant Vampire Squid. But essentially, he turned over the keys to the kingdom to the financial sector. Now they've got the money, and he's got no political leverage. And so the guys who got him elected have gotten exactly what they wanted in spades. And now, of course, the important question to me is, well, where's the money? Now, if you start off with the assumption that that $12 trillion and all the money that was stolen before then is gone, which I don't, there's several ways of – but if you do take that assumption, there's several ways of financing the Republic going forward. One is to cut the military and preserve retirement benefits. One is to cut retirement benefits and preserve the military. A third is to jam the creditors through inflation or radical devaluations. And the fourth is to institute radical change. And that includes getting back some of the money that's been raked off or stolen. The challenge, the meaning of the Massachusetts vote, I believe, is not so much that the people were against health care reform, which they were, or cap and trade or pilfering of 401ks or any of other things. But I think what had happened was we saw with the coming of the state and local government cutbacks and the extreme pressure that it would put on the state systems if the health care bill had passed, we saw a real organizing and coming together of many different disparate groups against the federal government and against sort of what I would call the New World Order. And I talked last week and on the blog about the Arizona governor's State of the State address, where she said that 14 attorney generals were organizing to assert 10th Amendment rights on the health care legislation. And if her attorney general would not join with those 14 attorney generals, that she would, which is very strong. I mean, those are fighting words for a governor, particularly in a state of a state. And I think the the pushback was getting so strong and was going to have such a powerful impact on the cash flows that the powers that be said, you know, time to pull the plug on all of this. We've gotten our $12 trillion out. You know, we're better served by having a president who becomes, in essence, after his first year, a lame duck. So now we see Obama in the vise between the creditors, the military, and a combination of labor and the retirees with remarkably little political clout for a president going into his second term, doing very poorly in the polls and yet still accountable, and he's in the middle of the grinding of the gears without much clout. A very bad signal. I talked earlier about my feeling that Tiger Woods had had a very powerful branding impact on helping Obama get profiled and elected president. We saw last week a new Vanity Fair cover that basically shows Tiger Woods made out to look like sort of a black teenage hoodlum, not a good sign. So watch people start to pull away, leave the administration. More news on unemployment. Unemployment continues to rise, and I have a real concern that the Massachusetts referendum is going to be used as an excuse to say, well, now we can't afford bailouts. The idea being we can always, we can always afford bailout of banks, but suddenly whenever people need money, there's no money. But unemployment is continuing to rise, and I think will continue to rise. And it's, as I predicted in the wrap-up, it's going to be, for me, it's going to be in the United States the biggest story of the year. Now, over at the Fed, some very interesting going on. We have the Bloomberg lawsuit. We have all sorts of consternation about the Fed deal with AIG. Again, it's not surprising that you see Volcker standing next to the president as he announces new reforms with Timmy Geithner, several people over. Ben Bernanke, in what was really in many ways a very astute move earlier this week, announced that he has asked the General Accountability Office, which is the congressional auditing arm, to do an audit of the Fed's aid to AIG. It's really a way to delay and diffuse and control the whole process. Now, the Senate has not yet voted on his reappointment. That was expected to happen this week. And now there's sort of a question mark hanging in the air. Is that vote going to happen? If he's not reappointed by the time the deadline comes, there's a possibility he could have to step down until he's reappointed. And what that means is we could see ourselves in a week or two with a situation in Washington where there is a real vacuum of power. You have the Fed chairman, the secretary, the Fed chairman temporarily out, the Secretary of Treasury, in essence a lame duck with a lot of people shooting for him. He could go, and the president being converted to a political lame duck. So it's we have the State of the Union address coming next Wednesday night. That's the 27th. I normally don't watch the State of the Union address. This week it's going to be very interesting. I may even break down and watch it. Now, on a positive note, I wanted to mention I am just a huge fan of Sting. And I had the opportunity last night to watch Sting's new DVD. It's called A Winter's Night Live from Durham Cathedral. And it's a two-CD set, or two-DVD set, one DVD being the live concert of his new album, which is an album I just absolutely love. If you're not a Sting fan, though, it might not be for you. But and also a documentary of how the music was chosen and produced, and so how the artistic creation came to occur of both the album and the DVD. It's a great example of really fine artistic creation, but also great leadership. I first really got interested in Sting in the early 1990s when I saw his Gold album. He made a DVD about the making of his Gold album, which was an album in which he brought together artists from all over the world, including Bradford Marsalis on soprano sax. And you literally see him bringing together lots of different worlds and lots of different cultures and literally creating a new kind of music. And it's really, he's inventing a new culture or field, if you will. And I was watching him and saying, you know, it's interesting because in Washington I used to always watch the great financiers. They were very, very interested in art always. And I came to realize, you know, money can't get together and create new markets globally. if people can't get together and sort of link their cultures in positive ways. And it's really the artists who lead that. Well, as you watch this fabulous new album, Sting tells the story of someone came to him and asked him for a Christmas album, and you could see from his face, oh, this is something I just can't do. But then he said, you know, what I can do is I can make a winter album, and I can explore both our sacred and our cultural history, you know, the sacred and cultural nature of winter, which includes Christmas. And he's really what I call dreaming up a new dream. We have a wonderful member of our network, Paul Levy, whose website is Awaken in the Dream. And I just posted his new album, and he is also a huge Sting fan. And Paul writes about how do we reinvent our culture and how do we reinvent our world. And that's one of the things he shares with Sting. And as you watch Sting go back, he goes back to the place where he grew up, and he goes back to that part of England, and he explores all the different cultures and roots. He brings together artists from Scotland and from Ireland and from France and different musicians, music from different times. And he does something in a funny kind of way, like he did with the Gold album, where he's reconnecting to our oldest stories and our oldest dreams and using it to dream up a new world, but one that's very, very grounded in the beauty and strength of our oldest stories. And you get the feeling, you know, it's not a feeling you get a lot these days when you watch the news, of, oh, that's right, we come from something we can be proud of that's full of just, you know, great strength. And it's really wonderful. It's a reminder that that there's great appreciation in our culture for excellence and great art. You know, I always remind people Dickens and Shakespeare were wildly popular. And Sting reminds me of that quote from Shakespeare. I put it up on the blog this week. In measure for measure, never make impossible that which is unlikely. I'm sure if anybody had told you that one of the most popular Christmas albums of the year was something that was this rich and serious as a piece of art, you would have said it was impossible. But Sting has proven once again that it's not. So if you're interested in thinking about reinventing from the deepest dreams of our culture and some of the richest, oldest stories, I recommend it to you. Okay, ask Catherine. Great question. Federal Reserve rate hike. What is your sense about raising the cost of credit? Do you sense the next Fed meeting will raise rates? Is anything else likely to raise capital costs? So the Federal Reserve Committee is not the one doing so. The Fed is in a real conundrum this year. We have a huge option arm rollover coming. I've put graphs up on the blog that show it. So far, what we've digested in the housing market is the refinancing of the subprime mortgage market. This year and next year, we're coming into refinancing the prime mortgage market. We have a huge amount of option arms that are need reset, and many of which are underwater. So there's a real need to keep interest rates low to manage those. In addition, if you look at the cost to the Treasury of the national debt if interest rates rise, very expensive. So there's tremendous pressure to keep interest rates low if possible. My prediction is that during 2010, we are going to see force and the equivalent of what I call disaster capitalism used to, you know, we're going to use war and force to keep interest rates low rather than raising interest rates a lot. And in fact, that's what we've seen recently in the last week. Rates have trended down. So another great question. How much lower could housing go? A lot of what happens to housing this year is going to depend on what place. There's going to be great diversity of performance in the market place by place, and also the type of housing. The second big issue is how much of managing the overall debt bubble is going to be handled through inflation. So with my prediction is we're going to see a reasonably slow burn kind of inflation. And what that means is that you're not going to see housing drop more than about 5 to 20%, depending on what place it is. And the challenge is going to be how we handle the unemployment spiral. The key right now to housing is that we're going to see a change in the ratio of how much it costs to buy housing versus how much it costs to maintain it, with real pressure on maintenance costs, property taxes. Much of the housing stock that's been built over the last 20 years is very poorly positioned for the current economics. So you see houses that require long commutes, require lots of oil and or gas, are not well insulated. And so the key with housing is going to be, how do you reposition the housing stock to be affordable and cost-effective in this environment? The most the toughest question I got, a very good one from David, is, let me just read it. Should we place any credence in the speculation that in some way the U.S., or more specifically the U.S. military, caused the earthquake in Haiti? This question is in the context of a known interest of the military in controlling weather over a battlefield. The speculation about Katrina and the speculation following a prior earthquake about whether seismic exploration by ships in the area of a known fault line caused the earthquake in deep water, resulting in tremendous damage from tidal waves. In this context, could this be a second experiment? What is behind our country's unusual interest in Haiti following this tragedy? One speculation I've read is that there is oil in the water surrounding Haiti, and our oil companies want control of Haiti's deep water ports and a site for an oil refinery. Now, I think it's really important to understand that what will happen in Haiti is what I call an economic hit. I think there are two possibilities. One is that the earthquake was induced and the relief effort is in essence an invasion. The second is the earthquake was natural. A lot of the death coming in part from the austerity measures and sort of economic warfare that's been wreaked on Haiti in the last 20 or 30 years, if not longer, and that the response is still going to be what I call an invasion. It is, if you look at the dollar index from the time of the earthquake, it's possibly an argument for the possibility, you know, that something deeper is going on here. We've had interest rates down, dollar up. You know, I've talked before about why I have real concerns about what happened in the tsunami and Katrina. But either way it happens, we're going to see patterns over time. Over the next year or two, we're going to see patterns that will tell us a lot about how this situation is being exploited by the U.S. and by the big corporations that are going in. We saw literally a day or two ago, only days after the earthquake, the Wall Street Journal had an entire special section on disasters as engines of economic development. My prediction is that the events in Haiti are going to have a profound impact, but we're not going to understand them without watching this over time. My hero of the week is Michel Chadadowski of Global Research. I just posted his latest article about the Southern Command up on the blog. It's beneath the Who's Your Sheriff post. And it's about the fact that the Southern Command had an exercise on relief to Haiti in the event of a hurricane that was literally underway a day before the earthquake. And I would just note, when you read it, that it shows how the military is moving to use NGOs and other civilian entities, literally coordinated in this kind of situation. And it's quite chilling, but it's another incredible contribution by Michelle. So that's it for Ask Catherine, and now it's my real pleasure to introduce you to somebody who's very, very special, Sheriff Richard Mack of Arizona. Richard, are you with us?
I'm here, Catherine. Yes, thank
okay.
you for having me.
Well, I was going to introduce you. You have quite an impressive history, but I thought I would ask you to first describe your background and how it was you came to appreciate so deeply the oath that a sheriff or an enforcement officer in this country gives to the U.S. Constitution. And if you could just walk us through how that came to happen, I would really love to hear the story again.
How much time do we have?
Well, for this one, we have about 3 minutes. I should just say, Richard, we have gotten, I've never gotten more questions from the audience for a speaker, so I have many questions for you.
Well, that's nice to hear. Well, I started my police career in Utah, and I started as a meter maid and then worked my way up and ended up as a patrol sergeant and front desk sergeant and worked a stint in undercover while I was at the beginning part of my career and absolutely hated that. And then I went back to patrol a little bit, and I started questioning a little bit what law enforcement was doing. But believe me, I was not a constitutional cop. I was not worried or concerned about the oath of office. It was just a ceremony to get a check and a job. I got into law enforcement because my father was an FBI agent. I actually tried to get an FBI, and it never worked out. And while I was with Provo Police Department, I had an epiphany occur to me while I was writing a lady a ticket. And it hit me while I was writing this lady, this poor lady and her poor family and her poor kids and her cruddy old car that wasn't worth $300. I realized that I had become a by-the-numbers jerk, and I decided that I wasn't going to be a liar and a hypocrite anymore, and I started studying my oath of office, and it nearly caused me to quit my job. I felt so shameful about it that I was overcome by the shame that I felt. And so instead of quitting my job, I decided to quit being a liar and a hypocrite, that I would keep my oath, that I would learn and study the Constitution, that I would know and understand the Founding Fathers. And while I was thus employed, I made a solemn commitment and a second oath to myself that I would never be on the wrong side again. And so I continued my police career, but I started getting a little bit of a reputation as a constitutional nut or zealot.
Mm-hmm.
And one time my chief even asked me, he says, yeah, I get this Constitution stuff, but he says, do you always have to wear the Constitution on your sleeve? And I didn't respond to him. I just, you know, kind of took it as a rhetorical question. And I said, you know what? Where else should we put our Constitution? The same place all the other politicians put it? On the back
burner?
You know,
it's such a beautiful document, but in day-to-day enforcement, we're so far from it.
Oh, no kidding. No,
yeah.
Well, see, that's another thing that caused me such disdain and even discouragement, that I looked on one hand what government was doing and looked at the Bill of Rights and the Constitution on the other hand, and there was no similarity whatsoever. Judges weren't following the Constitution, legislatures weren't following the Constitution, and certainly the President of the United States was not following the Constitution. I said, so what is all this about? And it just looked like everybody was lying so that they could follow political correctness. The Constitution has had absolutely no place in our government for the, you know, past 50, 60 years, and it just keeps getting worse every year. We are a nation that is after good ideas and entitlements and unjustifiable wars. We are not seeking the principles of freedom that our country was founded upon.
So tell us when you decided to run for sheriff.
And then I started, even with my reputation at Provo Police, I started getting promoted. You know, I was a good leader. I was a good officer. And I was dedicated to my job and dedicated to the people, and I started getting promoted, and then everything's going perfect. And you know what happens in your life when everything's going great. The in-laws call. And so my wife's parents are calling and saying, you've got to move home and run for sheriff. We're going to have a very corrupt sheriff if you don't get home and save us. And I told them, no way. I said, there's no way I'll do it. I said, you're crazy. I said, I've got 11 years on. I can retire in 9 years. I'm not going to do it. And I said, I'll come home in 9 years and do it, but I'm not going to do it yet right now. And so then they had other people in the community down here in Arizona calling me and saying, hey, we really need you. And so my wife agreed with me for the first time in our married lives that her parents were crazy.
Yeah.
And so I said, well, let's make a pro and con list, and we'll just send it down to them and show them why we can't do it. And we came up with about 23, 24 reasons why we couldn't move home, and only about 3 or 4 reasons why we could or why it would be a good idea. And most of that was just moving, you know, getting closer to her parents and my parents, which we've always loved both sides of the family. And we want, you know, we kind of thought it'd be nice to have the kids closer to both their grandparents. And so we made that list, and I don't know what happened, but 3 weeks later we moved home and ran for sheriff.
And you won.
And I won. And then that was 1988, and then in 1992 I was reelected, and then in 1993, November of 93, Bill Clinton signed the Brady Bill into law, and I thought it was just kind of a farce because, yeah, I don't want this to really shock you or anything, but he kind of lied about what the Brady Bill was.
Right.
I know that's really hard for people to understand that Bill Clinton could lie. You know, but anyway, he did. He lied about it. And then when then we were at a meeting of the Sheriff's Association of Arizona, and there's only 15 counties in Arizona, so only 12 of us were at the meeting, and 3 agents of the BATF bring us this document that told us, said basically these are your marching orders to comply with the Brady Bill. We didn't ever know that we were supposed to enforce the Brady Bill until that day. We didn't know that we were being compelled by the United States Congress, as Judge Fernandez in the Ninth Circuit said, dragooned into federal service.
Right, which is unconstitutional. The Congress cannot directly order and enforce a state enforcement officer as to what they should do.
They can't tell us what to do.
Right.
And so anyway, I decided at that meeting that we had to do something about it, and all the sheriffs were against it. There wasn't one sheriff that thought this was a good idea. Democrat, Republican, nobody. Nobody liked it. And I certainly wasn't being the most vocal about it because I was the younger sheriff in the state at the time, and I was still kind of, getting my way around. So I didn't have any visions of grandeur to say, hey, well, I'm just going to stop this whole thing by myself then. You know, there's no way I was thinking that.
Right.
But I did believe that the sheriffs unitedly could have just, said no. If all the sheriffs, or even a majority of the sheriffs in Arizona, had said, hey, we're not doing this. You can take this Brady Bill and shove it up 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. We don't care.
Right.
We're not doing the Brady Bill in Arizona. If the sheriffs had done that, they would be completely within their rights. We could have started this great push towards state sovereignty and sheriff nullification, as all sheriffs have a responsibility to do. And we are, the sheriffs, responsible for what is enforced in our counties. And I don't care where it comes from, federal, state, local, whatever. We are in charge of making sure that the enforcement of laws in our county are constitutional and in the proper service and protection of our people.
Right.
And so anyway, I drove home from the meeting pretty upset, and not knowing where to go, and I pretty much decided by the time I got home that I was going to sue the federal government to stop this Brady Bill thing. And when I walked in and saw my wife, I just blurted it out. I said, I'm going to sue the federal government to stop the Brady Bill. And she goes, what are you talking about? And I said, I'm serious. The Clintons and the Bradys and all that in Congress have made a law called the Brady Bill, and it forces me to participate in a federal gun control scheme that I know is unconstitutional, and it's going to force me to violate my oath. And that's what happened. But
I wanted to mention one thing.
Yeah,
Richard, during the Clinton administration, there were extraordinary numbers of steps done to connect sheriffs and local enforcement to federal funding and federal programs. It wasn't just the Brady Bill. It was, you had the community policing grants. You had tremendous numbers of dollars coming through on asset forfeiture.
That was a big push, and also his big push to put 100,000 more police officers on the road that he said were going to be funded by the federal government. Well, that is a lie. They only paid for a year and a half.
Right. So there was a real effort to get the sheriff's offices and local enforcement very financially dependent and sort of wrapped up with the federal programs.
Right. It was a there was a real buddy system, a real stroking going on between
right.
the feds and equipment, issuing more equipment and guns and helicopters and anything and everything else to local police departments and sheriff's offices. Yes, you're right.
Right.
So you went ahead and you sued.
Okay, I was the first sheriff in the United States to file a lawsuit against the Clinton administration to stop the Brady Bill. And this was the first time, you need to understand, this was the first time in history where the United States Congress made a law commandeering county officials to enforce federal laws and threatening to arrest us if we failed to comply. And that's
so,
all.
So in the legislation there was criminal liability for not complying?
Correct. Yes.
Okay.
And so the first thing I did was seek an injunction against the federal government that they couldn't arrest me while we were in court, while we were in litigation. And we got it. Judge John Roll in Tucson granted the injunction over the objection of Janet Reno. Janet Reno issued a memo and saying that part of the Brady Bill saying that whoever knowingly fails to comply is subject to a year in jail or a $10,000 fine or $1,000, I can't remember which. Anyway, a fine, a large fine, did not apply to the sheriffs, only to the gun shop owners. And Judge Roll said, well, Janet Reno doesn't get to change the law because she writes a memo.
So you took this to district court and then to the Supreme Court.
Well, yeah, kind of. We won at the district level, and then some other sheriffs joined the lawsuit. Sheriff
right,
Prince,
so you consolidated.
And then Sheriff Prince and I were consolidated to the Ninth Circuit, where we're both from.
Right.
And he and I, and then we lost at the circuit level. The Ninth Circuit is the most overturned court in America, the most liberal court in America. And then the sheriffs in the Fifth Circuit won unanimously there. And so we had a conflicting circuit court level decision, or two of them. And so anyway, a controversy existed between the circuit courts. And so the Supreme Court agreed to hear the case. And Judge and Sheriff Prince and I ended up at the Supreme Court together. December of 1996.
And you won. The opinion is quite extraordinary.
It is the most powerful 10th Amendment decision
ever
in the history of our country.
Yeah.
It really is. No question.
And
I challenge anybody to read it. If you don't believe me, I'm just the
man. I've read it.
You know, but yeah. Well, I'm talking about anybody else listening, too.
Yeah.
Everybody should read the case. Everybody should read my book, The County Sheriff, America's Last Hope, and read this. Now, there's a lot of the case in my book, but it doesn't do nearly justice of the whole thing. It's a very powerful 10th Amendment decision. It proves once and for all that sheriffs are the ultimate authority and that states are absolutely not subject to federal direction.
Right.
And neither are sheriffs.
Right. And
the president of the United States cannot tell your sheriff what to do.
Right. Especially if the state attorney general and the governor back him up.
Oh, heck yeah, that would be nice. And the one I would like to have backing me up the most is the county attorney.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But the state attorney general, yes, and the governor. And I had the governor, who was Fife Symington at the time,
uh-huh.
he came out in big-time support of what I was
Oh, doing. That's great. Well, yeah. And part of the issue, although I know it wasn't the core issue, is if the federal government can simply mandate work for the local officials, then essentially they soak up all the revenues. And instead of the state government doing what it's supposed to be doing, it's instead, you know, literally using all its money to do things that the federal government has made up.
Yeah.
So part of it is an economic issue. Well, let's step back and explain what a sheriff is. Because believe it or not, many of us, Richard, really don't know. We really don't know who our sheriff is and how that relates to our local police. You know, the difference between police and sheriff, and then we don't know how to figure out, well, who's who in
yeah.
enforcement in our town and county and how we go about assuring that we have the right people in office and not the wrong people.
Well, that's probably the $10,000 question. And, having the right sheriff is absolutely vital, and if you have a corrupt sheriff, man, oh, man, are you in trouble?
Yes, I know all about that.
Yeah, because, you know, he has such a powerful position. Now, most sheriffs, regrettably, do not know and understand their true power. or their true responsibility. And the true power is that they are the most powerful position of law enforcement in the United States. And in their county, they reign supreme. There is nobody superior to the sheriff. And when it comes to law enforcement, I can tell you by experience, the 8 years I was sheriff, the 20 years I was in law enforcement, and the 3.5 years I spent suing the federal government and winning, you put all that together, and I connect all the dots in my book, The County Sheriff, America's Last Hope. And by the way, you can get that at sheriffmack.com.
Yeah, and but, you can get, there are two other books, because I read The Proper Role of Law Enforcement, The County Sheriff, America's
one.
Last Hope, and then from My Cold Dead Fingers, Why America Needs Guns.
Right.
And I found them all very useful, very, very useful.
Thanks, yeah. You know, my favorite quote in from My Cold Dead Fingers, Why America Needs Guns, is from John Roll, Judge Roll, in the district court case, where he said, quote, Mac is thus forced, and by the way, that's on page 158, Mac is thus forced to choose between keeping his oath or obeying the act.
Right.
And that's such a powerful principled statement from him, because he really got it. He got the reason why I filed the case. They were forcing me to violate my oath to comply with an unconstitutional federal mandate to participate in a federal gun control scheme that was completely and entirely unconstitutional. And so I was so thrilled that Judge Roll got the principle of the man, I got a click there. Somebody's trying to call me. But I will not interrupt the show for that.
I have a friend who was down in New Orleans during Katrina,
mm-hmm.
who told me very powerful stories of sheriffs who really stood up to the federal government, and it made a huge difference to the safety and well-being of our families. And one question I got from one of our, actually he's a member of our team, was what would happen in a situation like Katrina where you have federal government contractors coming around trying to confiscate, in that case it was weapons, but it could be any assets.
You know, it's really important, I think, for the sheriffs and the counties to provide some real leadership with that, and make sure your counties are prepared where you don't need anyone else coming in and taking control of your county. When or if martial law is ever declared in our country, which seems to be some of the indications that this might be occurring sometime, that your county sheriff should be able to tell FEMA or other federal agents or agencies that we are completely prepared here, go someplace else, because we don't need you.
Right, and if you look at the federal manpower, you know, they can't be every place. So if you can take care of yourself, you know, internally, there's real benefits to me as a practical matter.
Self-reliance and county reliance and independence on food supplies and communications and other, you know, right now in Arizona we're having floods.
Right.
In fact, I just went to look at a couple of washes near my home with my wife. So she was going to go into town just an hour ago, and the washes were running to the extent that she needed to take my truck. And this is the thing. If we can have some very serious floods here in this area because we're flat and we're a desert. And if you get us a couple of inches of rain, we're going to have floods here, plain and simply. And I would hope that our area would never take the position of, well, FEMA or the federal government will always take care of us, so we don't need to be prepared here. We need to be prepared for disasters, natural disasters, those that would have a likelihood of occurring here. But food storage, I think, is also very necessary, both personally for your family and for your community. Because I'll tell you what, history has taught us that whoever controls your food controls you.
Right.
And I do have a corporate sponsor that is freezedryguy.com, who I get my food
supplies
from. Yeah, freezedryguy.com. Excellent food. He has real meat, and I've been using his products for years, years and years.
Now, so let's go back to, say, I'm listening to this, and I could live in a big city or right. I could live in a suburb, or I could live in a small town. So there's a wide, you know, there's a wide variation state to state and place to place as to, you know, who's really has jurisdiction. So is it the local police, which is really the appointed municipal enforcement, or is it the county sheriff? And how do I go about finding who's who in my place, whether it's my town or my county, and getting involved in a positive way to make sure these kinds of things are happening and I'm contributing? What do I do?
Well, first of all, you might ask your local sheriff if he knows and understands the jurisdictional differences and the difference between a chief of police and a sheriff. The sheriff has more responsibilities, I can tell you that right now. He runs a jail. He also is the paper server for the courts. And he has police jurisdiction throughout the entire county, whether it's inside the incorporated areas or non-incorporated areas of the county. There's usually a gentleman's agreement between the police departments and the sheriff's office that they will patrol and do their work inside the incorporated areas of the city where it is. Like, if for instance, Phoenix and Mesa in Arizona are big cities, and they certainly have police departments there. But they do not supersede the sheriff, and the sheriff has concurrent jurisdiction with those agencies inside the city limits. It's just basically most of the time he will stay out and leave them to do their business. But if the sheriff wants to enforce something inside Phoenix or Mesa or any other city in his county, in Maricopa County, which is the Phoenix area, then he certainly can do so, and Sheriff Joe Arpaio has done so, and he's gotten the local police departments mad at him a few times. And you know what that is? It's just too bad. You know, it's too bad. He can. That's why there's some places like Las Vegas that has Las Vegas Metro, which is really a misnomer because it's actually the Clark County Sheriff's Office. The Clark County Sheriff's Office is the only police department in Clark County, which is all of Las Vegas area.
For many years, I've been encouraging all my subscribers and readers, whenever we come into election time, there's tremendous focus and energy on the presidential campaign, and I keep trying to encourage people to really understand who and what is in control locally, because if you control 3,100 counties, it doesn't matter who's president.
I got to interrupt you a minute and take a call from my wife. I think she's out there in the flood, and she's got to – hang on.
I'll just give him a minute.
Okay, my wife is talking to me about the flood thing, and I told her to come on and try to go across the wash.
Oh, no, I hope she's okay.
Well, it's nothing that she could drown in, but it could stall the vehicle. So if she calls me back, that means I got to run out after her.
Okay. So, well, before she calls back, if you could just explain briefly what the 10th Amendment movement is and why it's something we want to know about.
Well, first of all, the 10th Amendment is a part of the Bill of Rights. And the Bill of Rights is the ultimate supreme law of the land. It was specifically put in the Constitution to prohibit Congress or the federal government from ever touching or violating or encroaching upon these principles that of freedom that can absolutely never be violated. That's why the founders thought that Congress would understand Congress shall make no law, or the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. But obviously, government doesn't get that. When they think they have a better idea than the founding fathers, man, they're not going to let these rules get in the way. But the purpose of the Constitution was to limit government, and the purpose of the Bill of Rights was to absolutely put 10 basic untouchables. These are the 10 untouchables that government cannot even think about encroaching upon. And so when you have the 10th Amendment there saying, okay, this is now the state's responsibility to stand against federal intervention and federal incursions, and my case makes that, in fact, it uses the word incursion.
The 10th Amendment affirmed by your case really gives to me a very compelling argument that you know, the states have very powerful law to prevent federal action in the state over across the line of the Constitution.
And let me put that a different way. The way it says it in the case is to reduce the risk of tyranny and abuse from either front.
Right, but here is the rub. The federal government has the ability to print money, but the states don't.
Yeah.
And what we've been watching for the last 50 years is the basically the states consenting to federal intervention and to serving as the federal enforcement officer because it makes them money.
Right.
And the feds have been able to do that because they print money,
That brings us to the other point, that they're going to say, well, if you don't do what we say, we're going to withhold funds. And the states have got to play that game with them. Where do you think, besides just printing their own money, that the feds get the money in the first place? The states send it to them.
Well, the citizens send some in the form of taxes.
Well, yeah, that's another thing. But those are still citizens of the state. And if the states get smart, they'll say, from now on, we'll collect all federal income tax.
Right. Now there's another part, which is if you look at who's collecting the deposits or the investments, the states are sending even more money in the form of investments, whether it's by the citizens or the pension funds.
Well, yeah. Well, who collects gasoline tax?
Right.
Even for the federal government, the state.
Right. But a great deal of how the federal government has financed its operations is not from taxes or even domestic investments, it's from global investments.
Right.
And that's where the huge subsidy is coming in that gives the Fed its advantage. One of the things I noticed when California issued their IOUs, one of the things that collapsed the situation was J.P. Morgan Chase and some of the big banks refused to take the IOUs. And so when the state did try and create its own paper, The big New York Fed banks who manage the federal government finances refused to take the paper.
Yeah.
But ultimately, I think, you know, the Tenth Amendment issues are also going to come down to, can we re-engineer the currency and the cash flows in a way that gives the states the economic clout they need to basically enforce the Tenth Amendment?
Yeah. Well, if the feds, though, play the money card and they want to play the money game, the states, especially the governors and legislatures, have got to stand up against that. And I'll tell you what, the first state that cuts off the federal government and plays that game with them and withholds funds from the feds, that'll be the richest state in the union. That's where I'm moving. I'll live in that state.
Well, we all want to know, Richard, what state do you think it's going to be?
I would think top on the list would be Texas. Maybe a Montana, maybe a Tennessee, but Texas would be my first guess. And I don't think Arizona's too far. I would put Arizona in the top 10.
Do you think that what happened in Massachusetts reflected a fear that 10th Amendment, you know, and secession fever was getting remarkably organized at the state level?
I think so. I think whether it's that particular issue, but I think there is no question about it, that sent a huge message to the federal government and to the Obama administration. You better start listening, because we don't like what's going on, and we've warned you, and we've warned you, and if you keep trampling on our freedoms, this is only going to get a lot worse. Do I hold out a lot of faith that the Republicans are going to restore freedom in the Constitution? Well, they certainly don't have a history of it, but this is... This is a huge uprising from we the people.
Yeah, no, I agree. Now, before you go, I also wanted to ask you, sheriffs are responsible for foreclosures and seizures.
Yes.
And we've begun to see sheriffs around the country just say, I'm not foreclosing anymore. You know, this is just, I'm not doing it.
The biggest one on that was the Chicago sheriff, Sheriff
right.
Dart. He refused,
Cook County.
He refused to do them. That's the Cook County, yeah.
And so sheriffs could have a powerful influence on preventing predatory practices by banks. Do you think that could happen?
All sorts of things. The sheriff can stop any abuse coming out of Washington, D.C. I don't care if it's from the United Nations. I don't care if it's from Interpol. I don't care if it's the IRS. The sheriff can have a huge impact against all of that.
Okay, so Franklin Sanders and I are always getting asked the question, can my gold be confiscated? Will my gold be confiscated? And I'm warning people now.
If your sheriff doesn't allow it.
Right. Right. That there's a line that can stop it. And I think, but, you know, we can't wait until somebody announces a confiscation of something to get to know your sheriff. So let me circle back to, you know, it's different states are different, different counties are different, but how do I just start to get to know my local enforcement? Do sheriffs and police have meetings or?
Yeah, some of them do. We did when we were here. Some of them don't, but it's like you said, it's different in each county. And what I suggest the first thing you do is make sure your sheriff has a copy of my book. And that's a good way to open the door where you can go in and talk to him and ask him what he thinks of it and ask him if he's ever heard of the case where a couple of small-town sheriffs beat the United States federal government at the U.S. Supreme Court.
Right.
Don't you think your sheriff would like to know that?
I'm in a small town, so I know all the town council. The Southern National Congress had a, you know, what I thought was a beautiful statement addressed to sheriff, police, and other law enforcement officers about the importance of protecting citizens from unconstitutional actions. And I gave it to one of my town council members, and they came back and said, could I have copies? I want to give it to the sheriff. I want to give it to all the members of the town council.
Yeah.
And you know, giving them your book is a great idea.
Well, also, you need to, I'll say the chiefs of police have the same responsibility. They took the same oath. It's just right. The major difference there is that the chief reports to the town councilor, to the town manager.
Right.
The sheriff reports to you.
Right.
He has no other boss except we the people,
right.
The voters, his constituents. He reports to the people.
Now, last question. Could you explain the oath, Richard? Could you tell us what the oath is and explain what it means?
Well, the oath, I think it's pretty self-explanatory, but sure. The sheriff, quote, I, Richard Ivan Mack, solemnly swear or affirm that I will faithfully uphold, defend, and obey the United States Constitution and the Constitution of the State of Utah, and will, with full faith and allegiance, blah, blah, blah. Okay, that's done.
And that's police, that's sheriff, that's military too, isn't it?
Take all the same oath. The military one says all that, but also says that I'll protect those from all enemies, both foreign and domestic. Most of the sheriffs and police departments oath or police oaths don't say that, but it means the same. You have to protect and defend the Constitution from whoever's violating it. In your jurisdiction. So anybody in my county, in Graham County, that would be violating the Constitution, conducting random audits, seizing property, doing anything that's unconstitutional, taking people's property away from them without due process, is unconstitutional, and it's my job to stop it. Period.
Now, you're a member of Oath Keepers. Could you explain to us what Oath Keepers is?
Oath Keepers is a group that formed last April 19th, and it is completely dedicated to law enforcement, both current and retired, and military, both current and retired, and telling and exhorting each member and everybody in the United States, whether you're military or law enforcement, that you stand down and actually disobey any order that is unconstitutional. And that is exactly what I've been preaching for the last 20 years.
Wow.
And finally, there's an organization that actually got formed to concentrate on that very principle. We must have officers, because if tyranny comes knocking, it'll be in a uniform,
right?
Either military or law enforcement. So we need law enforcement and military to be educated about the Constitution, about American fundamentals and principles, and have officers who refused to go along with unconstitutional orders. Nuremberg trials took care of that thing about, what was it, the defense? Well, we were just following orders. Well, that doesn't
right.
count. It doesn't. That's no excuse.
Right.
You have a moral obligation to be honest in your dealings and in keeping your oath. And that's the only thing that matters. It is your mission statement. keep your word, keep your oath.
Well, you know, the more I, as I read your books and the more I read the lawsuit and the more I understand about how dual sovereignty and the lines of authority of the sheriff, the more I find it very rejuvenating, because there really is a very powerful law and case law in support of basic fundamental human rights.
Yeah.
And it's, I think it's wonderful to know, and I can't thank you enough for all you've done to help people like me understand what the, not just what the law is, but the extent to which it really can be affirmed. So
thanks.
With that, I just want to thank you. And if you could just once again give us your website.
Okay. You can get any of those books that you mentioned. Sheriff Mac, that's
uh-huh.
M-A-C-K. Sheriff is one R, two S, so sheriffmac.com. Go
thank
to the website,
so
and I'd be happy to talk with any of you and answer all any other questions anybody might have.
Okay, well, I wish you were my sheriff.
Well, you know.
We're working to get a great sheriff elected. We're working on it.
Hopefully you can either convince him and educate him, or.
Oh, he's getting your book. I can promise you that.
Okay, good.
Okay, thank you. Good night, Richard.
Hey, we'll see you later. Thanks for having me.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we look forward to being with you on Thursday, February 4th, for The Layman's Guide to Mind Control. This is designed in response to many questions I've gotten from you over the last year related to a wide variety of things, from control files to advertising to subliminal programming on TVs to Manchurian candidates. My emphasis is very practical. This is very different than any mind control thing I've seen. My focus is going to be on those techniques that impact our everyday life and that cause risk for us that needs to be managed, which whether it's our assets or ourselves. So it's not so much about mind control, but how mind control can mess us up and impact us and how to protect ourselves from mind control. One of the things that helps me do this is Hollywood has done an incredible number of movies on mind control. It's really amazing. It is all available in the movies. And I really recommend you watch Telephone, which is an early Charles Bronson movie made in the 70s, Charles Bronson and Lee Remick, and the 2004 production of Manchurian Candidate. It's the remake with Denzel Washington. I said last week, my apologies, that Telephone was available on Netflix and checked right afterwards, and to my amazement, it's not. To order another copy, I got one from Amazon. But it's really worth digging out if you're interested in mind control. So until February 4th, you're in our prayers. Please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. So good night and good luck.